welcome to Intimacy with the World podcast. This podcast has been on pause all summer. I've been traveling and I spent almost 2 months in the Faroe Islands where I grew up and where my ancestral roots are. I taught 2 yoga and meditation retreats there and did some coaching. But now I am back in Spain and I have some really great conversations coming up for you. I have, however, decided that I will put out a new episode more or less every 2 weeks, as I just don't have the time to publish a new conversation every week. So, I am really proud to begin this new season with a woman who has been mentoring me in mindfulness and meditation for almost 3 years now, the wonderful Devon Haase. She has been deeply engaged in meditation for more than 20 years in various Buddhist traditions and has been a meditation teacher, mentor, and retreat leader for many years. She has also written a book together with her husband, Nico Haase, who has also been on the podcast. So if you haven't heard that episode, then do check it out. We had a great conversation. Their book is called How Not to Be a Hot Mess: A Survival Guide for Modern Life. And Devon says about the book, it offers 6 pieces of sound advice for keeping steady in the spin. I have listened to the book on Audible and I highly recommend it, especially for young people. It is a really entertaining read and offers some important advice on how to stay centered in difficult times. Devon lives in Ashland, Oregon, together with her husband, but she also spends a lot of time alone in a retreat cabin up on a mountainside meditating. These years that I have known Devon, she always emphasizes the importance of sincere meditation practice. And she's actually right now preparing for a 1-year retreat, starting more or less when this podcast is aired. In our conversation, we got around to all sorts of interesting subjects. So please sit back and enjoy the insights from this wonderfully wise woman. So nice to meet you again.
Oh, thank you so much, Dorita. It's just a total pleasure and honor to be here with you.
Yeah, Devon has been my mentor for 2 years on the MMTCP program with Tara Brach and Jack Kornfield, a teacher training with them. And she's kept mentoring me even after that program ended. So I feel I know her and I feel really safe and relaxed to be here with you, Devon.
Absolutely, me too. And we know each other's practice and we have very similar backgrounds. So really happy to see where this conversation goes.
Yeah. So how about you start out by telling us why and how you came to meditation in the first place? Because you started very young.
Yeah. So I grew up here on the West Coast in the U.S. And I was actually the child of a former Catholic priest. Oh. My dad was a priest until he was 35, and then he left the church, disrobed, and met my mom. But I wasn't born until he was 50. So he was an older father, and he always lived a contemplative life. He was an at-home parent, and I would see him meditating in the morning. Uh-huh. Very early on, I remember, and I would join him sometimes, and I would just, you know, pretend like I was sitting with him and look around and, you know, notice my mind. And at some point, I remember I was young, maybe 8 or 9, and I remember him telling me, you know, can you imagine your mind is like an empty room? And you've taken all the furniture out and just sit in the sort of spaciousness of that empty room. And it made an impression on me, even so young, you know, I would sort of do that and very much admired my father. And so then when I came to be college age, I found a group of meditators in college. I was always interested. And so went on my first retreat at Spirit Rock Meditation Center. I went to a young adults retreat when I was a sophomore in college. Uh-huh. So that was the launch of it.
How old is one when it's a sophomore? Because they don't use that in Europe. How old? What age
is that? Yeah, so in the US, I was probably 19 when I went on my first retreat. And it was a 7-day retreat at Spirit Rock, but it was one of those like transformative experiences where I came back and I back then, that was 20 years ago, I said, I want to make this my life. And how do I do this? Meditation wasn't so mainstream then. So that's really been kind of my guiding question since then, is wanting to put meditation at the center of my life.
What was so transformative about that week retreat when you were 19? What was it that like made it so clear to you that this is what I need to do?
Yeah, I think there was something very powerful about having so much time just with my own mind and my own heart, and how difficult that was to really see, like, my goodness, my mind, I was really suffering at that age, sort of formative years, struggling with anxiety and sort of insecurity about who I was in the world, who I was going to be. And the power of just having a lot of silent time with this particular mind in nature, with others who had similar values. Over the course of that week, what I found was my heart really softened and I was more open to the world. Like, I remember having these moments with the lizards. There's a lot of lizards on the land at Spirit Rock. It's in California. And the way those lizards do their push-ups and the way they were in the sun, like, my heart just felt so connected to the myself and the world in a whole different way. So by the end of those 7 days, I saw the transformative potential of really being with our own pain in a way that can actually open our hearts, break our hearts open. And I thought, if I could do that in 7 days, there might be something to this. The potential felt quite profound even at that point.
So you never left meditation and that kind of path from that moment on?
Well, so back then, it was a little less obvious. I was studying psychology in college and I wanted to do research on meditation and its benefits. But that was 2001, and it was right in the very beginning of all this meditation research starting. So when I went to do my research for my undergraduate thesis, I was looking at meditation and how it might help folks with ADHD. And I found all this research done through the transcendental meditation movement, research that had been done in the early 80s, and that was a whole bunch of different research they were doing on that style of meditation. And then Dr. Richie Davidson out of Madison, University of Wisconsin, he had published three articles at that point when I was doing my research. And so I used those, and that was how I got to know who Richie is and, sort of aspired to go work with him at some point. So even in college, I had great supervisors who were, I think they sort of thought I was, weird to be doing this kind of undergraduate research on meditation. But I was able to then finish my degree, and it really was like, how do I next step look at meditation from all these different viewpoints? So after college, I was able to go to Asia, really lucky to go study there, did some retreat there, came back. So I was always sort of weaving meditation into, I did a couple other master's degrees, started teaching in public schools, and then teaching mindfulness in public schools. So always kind of finding a way to continue practicing, but it wasn't always obvious. Nowadays, like, lots of people are, finding ways to work in mindfulness, but back then it wasn't so easy. So I feel really lucky, actually.
Yeah, it was a lot less mainstream.
A lot less mainstream. And I
Yeah, and
think my parents
people
were kind of
wouldn't even
like,
have known what you were talking about if you said I'm a meditation
no.
teacher or something like that.
That's right. That's right. They didn't know. And then my parents were worried about me because I was going off to Asia and doing these retreats. What does that mean? So, yeah, it's been really a fortunate time, actually, to have been in it for so long now. And now lots of people are interested in meditation and it's, so many creative things happening there.
Why do you think that there are so many? Why do you think it's become mainstream now? just now at this point in time?
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, for example, in the 60s, there was also like lots of young people were into the Asian thing, and the Beatles went to India and they even sang about it and so on. So there was also a movement then to meditation and all these things. But now is when it's really mainstream, and you don't have to be a hippie to be meditating and to be into these things. So why do you think it is now?
That's right. Yeah, I actually think that Dr. Richie Davidson is one person who has really influenced this movement. All the neuroscience that's been done, really showing the very physiological benefits of meditation. It lowers your blood pressure. It helps you sleep. Can help with anxiety. I think our culture needs that kind of scientific proof for anything to get mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so just the sheer number of research articles that have been published in the last decade on meditation and mindfulness has been really driving the whole movement. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. And then I would say the second one is it's just this coming together of all these conditions that our culture is really more anxious than it's ever been. We have these challenges like we've never had before. And so I think really discovering a new tool that can help mitigate.
What kind of challenges do you mean?
Oh, gosh. Well, we can go really big, you know, climate crisis, pandemic, racism, oppression, structural issues all over the world around power and privilege. But then also individually, I would say, at least in the US, we have really high rates of anxiety, depression, insomnia. So on a macro scale and also on a more personal scale, I think everyone is really looking for how can I support, you know, this time of, you know, our minds are so reactive, we're so busy, everyone is really, I think, stretched to the max at this point. Yeah. And so something like meditation, where it's, you can do it at home, it's available now on apps. Yeah. It's really, you know, there's very few side effects that it's a really lovely, not a panacea, right? Definitely not a panacea, but a really wonderful tool to add to all of these other modalities, healing modalities.
So I can't help asking then, because I know that you've been doing this for more than 20 years, and I know that you're not just a meditation teacher, you're a deeply spiritual person. So all this meditation and mindfulness being very, very popular now and very mainstream, but not all of it has a spiritual dimension. Some of it is solely watching your mind or coming back to the breath or something like that. So what do you think about, for example, mindfulness, the spiritual dimension being taken out of it? What do you think about that?
Yeah, this is a big question. This is a big question. Mm-hmm. And I think especially in this time where we're really learning a lot about cultural appropriation and how to honor the historical roots of these traditions, I think we have to be really careful about taking mindfulness out of its context. And of course, I'm a Buddhist, right? I believe the whole thing. It's very much my religion. And so that's usually the orientation. You know, I'm teaching the Dharma, I'm teaching from a very Buddhist lens. And we're at this time in history in Buddhism where it's coming to the West for the first time. Buddhism has moved around from a lot of different cultures, you know, it moved north and east, and each time it encountered a new culture, it changed and, you know, shifted and transformed according to what was in place in that culture originally. And so this is what it looks like when Buddhism comes to a very secular culture. And it's fascinating to watch because Buddhism has never adapted to a secular culture before. So I'm not against secular mindfulness. I teach it also. But I think we need to be very thoughtful and just be asking this question around how do we honor the roots? How do we make sure we're not just cherry picking or appropriating what really isn't offered to us? How do we educate so that folks who want to practice mindfulness, they know they don't have to become Buddhist, but they at least know this is the context from where it came. Mm. So it's, I don't have any clear answers about it, but I think it's a question we need to be holding in mind as this spreads more and more.
Yeah, so that's one aspect of the question, the appropriation, the cultural appropriation. But also, what do you think about the, and this is not the right word, but I'm going to use it anyway, because I can't find another one, the effectiveness of mindfulness. Because I must say that in my own practice, in the beginning, it was a way of calming my mind and of watching my mind and getting to know myself, just watching my mind, getting to know my own mind. And it, I could see a lot of benefits in that and calming my mind. So it was a good method for that. But then it started evolving on its own to become more and more spiritual. And I just find that the more spiritual it becomes, it's much more effective. I don't want to use that word, but it's just the depth of it transforms your soul in a very beneficial way. Whereas if you don't have that added in, the change is not as big. That's my opinion. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
The transformation.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think that understanding our motivations and our intentions is really important. And that's part of understanding the historical roots, that when the Buddha taught this path, he was teaching freedom from suffering. You just point, you know, stop there. Really, that's such a radical view. He said, life is difficult. There's all these reasons that it's constantly changing and we can't really control. It's not governable. We're all going to get sick and eventually die in these bodies. And this path is a way off that cycle of suffering, the way to get out. So very radical promise and a very clear worldview. Worldview based in rebirth, in the cycle of samsara, the cycle of suffering. And so when we practice, we're getting out of all of that. That could be somebody's intention to practice, but somebody else could just be trying to meditate to have a little bit more calm in the morning, you know, or to lower their blood pressure or to live a better life here in this realm. And so I think there's no problem with having those intentions when we come to meditate, but I think it is good to understand what the original intention was, and then to know, okay, I'm here because I'm curious, or I'm here because it does help me in my relationships. It helps me be a better parent. Mm-hmm. And that's great. All of that is wonderful. And I think, sort of like you were naming, for a lot of folks, they'll come just out of curiosity or wanting to feel a little bit more peace or well-being. And then these doors start opening and maybe unexpected things happen, which can lead deeper into the benefits of the practice. But I will say, just as a caveat, that because it is so widespread and mainstream now, accessible, we are seeing that there's definitely counter examples. It's not always beneficial to all people. And so I think understanding the implications when we are meditating at home alone on an app without a community, without the support of a teacher, that we can sometimes get a little bit in the deep end of the pool too soon, and it can actually be harmful. So that's also part of the responsibility, I think, of all of us in the meditation world, is to understand what are the pitfalls, what are the risks involved, how do we avoid, how do we support folks who are really getting started and might not understand all the different conditions that can lead to a beneficial and deepening experience.
Yeah.
So all of this is, I think, integrity is really important as we continue. It's never done this before, right? It's the first time Buddhism has come. Yeah.
So in your, I find your trajectory within Buddhism really interesting, because you've practiced very deeply both in the Vipassana tradition, in the Theravada Buddhism and insight tradition, but also in the Tibetan tradition. And I know a little bit of both, not anywhere near as much as you do, but I find them extremely different. It's almost like, are both these Buddhism? They're so different, I find. So, and you're still very much in both of them. Practically, you have teachers, and you have teachers in both lineages and or in both traditions. So how do you how do you hold both? How come you haven't chosen one or the other? Or maybe you could explain to our listeners just a little bit what Theravada Buddhism is and how Tibetan Buddhism is very different.
Absolutely. Yes, I was laughing a bit because I think my teachers asked the same question on both sides. Why don't you just choose one? Sometimes yeah. There's a sense of we have everything you need. Why do you need two? So yeah, it's been an interesting trajectory for me. I did that first retreat at Spirit Rock, which is a Theravadin early Buddhist center. And so that was, you know, my first meditation experience was mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, really based on the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. Then I went to study abroad and I had the great good fortune to live in France for a year in college. And while I was in France, I started reading books by Mathieu Ricard. So I was reading these in French about Mathieu Ricard, this wonderful monk in the Tibetan tradition, French by origin. And so I read Le Moine et le Philosophe, I think, who is like a dialogue between Mathieu, who's a monk, and his father, who's a philosopher. And they were talking about Buddhist philosophy and actually ended up writing a term paper in France about Buddhism there, how the lot of Tibetan lamas actually ended up in France, building monasteries and doing 3-year retreats there in southern France. So that was the introduction to my Tibetan Vajrayana practice. And then I met my Tibetan teachers right when I came home from that year in France. So I've always had the parallel. It's always felt like I have some real draw, so much resonance with the Tibetan culture and the way they teach and their view of the mind, the nature of mind, very inspiring for me. And yet I've done a lot of my retreat practice at these early Buddhist centers like Insight Meditation Society, Spirit Rock. I just finished a teacher training there at Insight Meditation Society. So I'm really trained and transmitted in the early Buddhist tradition to be a teacher in that lineage, which I think is appropriate. My sense, this is just completely my view, that early Buddhism, Theravadin Buddhism, the way that it's being taught here in the US, especially at places like IMS and Spirit Rock, very accessible. You know, it gives very practical step-by-step tools about how to be in the body, how to know the mind, how to know thoughts and emotions. That to me feels like a very simple and accessible bridge into mindfulness. The Vajrayana is so complex. It's so wild, really, you know, when you start to get into it. It's a very indigenous practice. It's so rooted in Tibetan culture still. A lot of the chanting is still done in the Tibetan language, and it's beautiful for that. I love that cultural experience. And yet, I think it's difficult to teach and still in the early stages of getting translated to the West. So for that reason, I really enjoy having that as my personal practice, and then being in the more Theravadin circles, that landscape feels like it's somehow adapting more readily to secular culture at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I mean, I don't think you can practice Vajrayana Buddhism without having a dimension of faith or spirituality. I mean, I think it's impossible to practice Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism without, I mean, you can't do it with a secular mind, do you think?
I think that's true. Yeah. It's interesting because the early Buddhist teachers here in the West, I'm thinking of Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg. These are the, you know, white convert American Buddhists who went to Asia, Thailand, Burma, lived there in the 60s and 70s, and then came back here and very explicitly decided to let go of a lot of the cultural trimmings, not so much chanting, not so much ritual. They really taught the meditation aspect. And that, I think, is one reason why that form is the one that's spreading the most, I think, into mainstream circles. Whereas the Tibetans, and this is one reason why I enjoy having both, we do all the ritual, we have the chanting, we have all those cultural pieces still very much intact. And I think for also political reasons, because Tibetans are in a diaspora. It's very important, I think, to conserve their cultural traditions in a certain way. And so, yes, it is not as easily accessible. I agree. And it really requires a kind of religious faith, devotion, commitment to the lineage.
And what do you think about all the magical aspects of Theravada, of Vajrayana Buddhism? Like it's quite shamanic. It's very
so shamanic. Yes.
And it's very powerful.
It's so mystical, very, and that appeals to me, you know, coming from a very Western logical scientific frame. For me, I love that world of just the possibility of lots of things unknown, you know, things we don't see normally, or the view of the world as so many multidimensional, you know, time being multidimensional and space and, you know, the pantheon of deities. I love all of that. Not for everyone. But I also think there's something in the human soul, the human spirit, that longs for that kind of mysticism. And we're seeing it even in the early Buddhist traditions now in the West. There's a kind of inclining back to bringing back the chants, bringing back some of the rituals, the devotional aspects, really honoring Asian heritage Buddhists who have been carrying on those traditions here in the West. Mm-hmm. So I really think there's it's feeding something deep inside us that might be missing in our very secular world.
Yeah. Do you think that is something that is just in human nature, that we need that aspect of faith or of magic or of believing that the world is more than just what conventional science is telling us, that it's almost like a dead world that we're living in? Do you think that the human soul just longs for the mystical, for life to be really alive again, and the planet and the trees and everything to be mystical and alive? Do you think that it's embedded in what we really are?
I think so. You know, if you look at so many indigenous traditions have this, you know, the belief in beings maybe seen and unseen, and the sacredness of the world. I think that's a view that's really missing. And in some ways, that might be why we're in such a crisis with the climate and pandemic, is this cutting off of that part of ourselves that really needs to be connected to the divine or to the sacred. That's my belief. I also think there are some maybe who need that a lot less, you know, very sort of practical, salt of the earth. Certain people just don't have the same kind of need to be in the mystical all the time. So I definitely think there are different types, but for sure, yeah, I've needed to find it obviously in different ways, because it just feels so innate in us, yearning, for the mystical.
So you are a trained teacher in the, as you call it, early Buddhism, in the Theravada, the mindfulness, and you're very thoroughly trained there, and you teach a lot. But you have a teacher in the Tibetan, you have Yongye Mingyo Rinpoche is your teacher, and you've been practicing with him for many, many years, and you do a lot of intense retreat practice and so on. But would you ever teach that? Because it's very different, as you were saying yourself. Would you teach Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, with all its magic and its chants and all its deities and strange rituals and so on? What do you think about that?
That's a good question. Well, I haven't been authorized to teach in that lineage. And so, you know, at this point, I wouldn't, and I don't have a huge desire to do so. In fact, I love the view. I love practicing it. And there's something really nice about having my personal practice and then teaching from a tradition that it's also a huge part of my personal practice. And I love the early Buddhist tradition. So just to give a bit of background, there's this trend now, especially really guided by Bhikkhu Analeo, who's this wonderful German scholar monk who lives at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. He's done so many comparison studies between the early Buddhist suttas and then later developments in Chinese and Tibetan. He's really shown what is most likely the closest to the Buddhist teachings? Like, what most likely is closest to what he taught? And then all these later commentarial traditions that includes the Theravada. So I've been sort of using these interchangeably, but early Buddhism is really based in those closest, most ancient texts to what the Buddha taught. And then Theravada is the sort of Southeast Asia's version of the commentaries, right, that we see in Burma, Myanmar, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Laos. And those have very varying traditions, Mahasi Sayadaw, Ajahn Chah, Shwayumin Sayadaw. So sort of the progression from early Buddhism to Theravada, and then as it went north, it became, you know, Mahayana in China and Japan and Korea, and then finally Vajrayana being sort of the third cycle of teachings in Tibet. And I think Vajrayana is so shamanic because it blended with the Bun tradition, the original sort of animist shamanic practices that were already in Tibet, and also Hinduism. Yeah. So Vajrayana Buddhism, I think, is very much a blend of these three, Bun, Hinduism, and Buddhism. And it's very, yeah, it's foreign. It's not, yeah, there's very little about it that is Western. It's just not. And so as I continue to go deeper with those practices myself, I really have questions about how wide, like how should this be taught? You know, should it be available all over the internet? Should, there's something, of course, that's beautiful about it. It's a beautiful practice. It helps people. So there's, and my teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche, he has a big vision. You know, he has lots of students all over the world and they're all practicing and it's beautiful. It's sort of based in this goodness, wanting to help people. But there's other Tibetans and there's other more conservative views that really want to protect these ancient teachings so that they're not misused or misappropriated. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was naming some of the ways that meditation can go wrong, this is one way that folks who learn some of the more esoteric practices like Dzogchen or like deity practice, but don't have the foundational experience of just basic mindfulness meditation, they can get sort of confused, and actually it can harm people who go too deep too fast.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what we do in Western culture, is we appropriate and capitalize and then spread it all over the place, and we see that happening, and it's not necessarily, I think, the best thing. So I have two minds about it. I understand wanting to help a lot of people, and I also have this sense of, I don't know how these particular esoteric practices, how many people would this really help? Because it requires such a foundation, my experience, so many years of just foundational practice for it to be useful.
Yeah.
That it feels like a much slimmer number of people will even be interested in these. So those are some reasons why I'm hesitant to teach it.
Yeah, I think those are very interesting and very valid reflections. I'm glad we got to hear them. Because I think it's important reflections. You don't really give an answer, yes or no, but we do need to reflect upon these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you said that you had been, and I know this, you've been practicing very deeply and doing lots of retreat practice, like long, long retreats. So this is a question I always ask. I've never done any of those long, long retreats. I've never been more than 9 days on retreat. But so my question is, the retreat practices, when I know that you're going to start a retreat now in December, November and December, for a whole year, and you've done that before. It's not the first time. So you were saying that the world is so challenged now with the climate and the anxiety, and you're a teacher. I mean, wouldn't it be better if you stayed in society and and I'm playing the devil's advocate here, and contribute, like the society and the world needs people like you, Devon, and then you just go and retreat into a cabin and meditate for a year. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so this also is a good place to make a distinction between the two lineages. There's all this history of retreat in early Buddhist practice, where because at a certain point they were opening up to lay people practicing, and I think it was Lady Sayadaw, Mahasi Sayadaw, who created this 10-day retreat structure where people really could go deep and really create a lot of freedom in their minds, lay people, just on a 10-day retreat.
Yeah.
And so in the Theravadan tradition now, most of these retreat centers offer 7 to 10 day retreats, and they're much more accessible, you know, for those of us who have lives in the world. And I would say for most, that's really enough, you know, a couple of week long retreats a year, maybe a month if you can swing it. That has really, I mean, I know so many people who have just done that for years, and it's enough to go deep, and their progress is really, you know, profound and beautiful. In the Tibetan
but you're kind of
different.
But you're kind of slow, Devin, so you need a whole year, is that what
that's
you're
right
saying?
I am a little slow, that's it, it just takes me a lot longer. I know some, you could do it in 7 days though, probably, Dorita. Don't have to take 12 months. Yeah, so it's, so this is where we see difference in tradition, because in the Vajrayana their gold standard is a three-year retreat.
Yeah,
right. Very long, very secluded. And we see monks, you know, and yogis going off into caves for 12 years, for 20 years practicing. So I have to say, I'll admit to you, as a young person, I heard about that three-year retreat, or, you know, my retreats at Spirit Rock. And I did want to go because it was kind of an escape, you know, as a young person. I already saw, I was lucky to grow up in an environmental town where we were talking about climate even in my high school. Yeah. And sort of seeing the state of the world, there's a huge part of me that just wanted to leave. So I think that's the shadow of this model of wanting to get out of the world, and so we go on retreat. However,
yeah.
Because I know that about my mind, and I've done long retreat, doesn't work very well, because you go away and there you are with your mind, right? Yeah. It's not an escape at all. And in fact, often it feels harder to be in retreat than to be in the world. Because I'm an extrovert and I miss people, and I do feel concerned about what's happening in the world, and I have to sit all day long, sit and walk. And it takes also so much discipline. So that said, what I've seen thus far in my retreats is that they are in fact harder than when I'm in the world. And they're such fertile ground for growing these qualities of compassion, wisdom into what the world really needs, equanimity around what the situation is, and then moving from that place into a skillful response.
Yeah.
Insight into relationships and how to be a change agent in my organizations and my, you know, circles of influence. Those qualities are so deeply developed in a retreat setting, mm-hmm. that I feel like when I come out, it's sort of like jet fuel for then engagement.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get so caught in my own reactivity. I have more energy and resourcefulness. There's often creativity around how to respond to some of these seemingly impossible challenges that we have.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is really where my faith comes in for retreat, that even though I'd like to escape,
yes.
It's kind of impossible. And that it's their conditions that are growing these qualities that the world so badly needs.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm able to step out for a year and then come back and be doubly effective,
yeah,
that's
or
worth
more.
It.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you think about what you sometimes hear? You sometimes hear people say that, for example, a yogi, a very highly accomplished yogi in a cave in Nepal or Tibet or something, that they are bringing something to the collective consciousness by training their mind so highly. Like, what do you think about that kind of stance, that maybe even when you're in retreat and you're meditating, do you think that you're contributing to the collective? Well, it takes, you have to believe that there is a collective consciousness. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I certainly hope so. And in retreat, when I'm doing all of this, you know, developing bodhicitta, this care and concern for the world, I certainly hope that it's making a difference, you know, sending out all of these good wishes for the world. But I don't really know. I think they've tried to prove it. I don't think they've proven it yet. So there's a kind of not knowing, but a sense that I'm helping my own mind, right? At the very, very least, I'm growing a deeper sense of compassion that can then perhaps come to bear when I'm in relationship with others. So that feels like obviously the very least, and it is helping. And then, yeah, again, back to this mystical view, I believe all kinds of things are happening that we don't see and can't prove. So the more people, I think, the more people who are, secluded in nature, sitting with themselves, growing these qualities, I think it's benefiting the world for sure. I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my podcast is called Intimacy with the World.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned nature there. What role does nature play in your you live in Oregon. Is that a big place? Is that a city or
It's very remote, actually. We live in the mountains. Yeah, I live in a small town and surrounded by nature, lakes and rivers and forests, and not too far from the ocean. So it's very good for practice here, except that we're in a very real climate crisis. So we're having fires and smoke, a lot of it right now. But even that also feels like intimacy with the world, that we are really can't turn away from the situation that we're in. And I'm sure you know, and those who are listening who have done meditation and retreat, this practice grows your connection. Even if I'm in silence and I'm alone in a retreat cabin, there's something about, like, originally the connection I had with the lizards, or up in these mountains here, there's like so many birds that come and you get to know their cycles and you know the flowers that are coming at different times of the year. And there's such a beautiful sense of, I am part of this living aliveness, this organism that is the earth. And that view to me feels such a, it's so nourishing to remind myself of that. And then to move from that space, not a separation or the sort of independency that like the world has resources for me to use, but more a deep belonging, our participation in this world. And that doesn't have to look like being on the front lines all the time. That can look like sitting with a robin all morning and watching her make her nest, or listening to the chipmunks, listening to the creek. That to me feels like a really beautiful way to be intimate with the world.
I think it's so interesting how you said that when you go on retreat, it's actually not an escape. It's not a relief. It's actually the opposite. It's worse because you have to sit there with your own mind. So I think it's so interesting that you have this drive to you're going to go, you take the decision, I'm going to go on a 1 year retreat. And you know it's going to be difficult, but you want to do it anyway. What is that wish? Where does that come from? Where's that source come from that you still want to do it? That you don't want
I
to jump where the fence is the lowest.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind when you ask that is that most things that are worth doing are difficult, right? And there is that sense of there's a we meet our edges in practice. It is not easy. That's one thing about mainstream mindfulness is sometimes we get sold this like all you have to do is sit down and breathe and everybody can do it. And it's true, everybody can. And it's not going on retreat is not like those glossy cover image pictures of like peaceful sitting on top of a mountain. It is really messy in there in the mind, and there's all kinds of edges. So it's difficult, but it's sort of like running a marathon is difficult. And yet we do it because we know it's so beneficial on so many levels. And I think anything that we have discipline around, whether that's exercise or eating or the way that we live our lives, it's really, really worthwhile, right? I want to live a meaningful life. And so, meaning, I think, comes from some elbow grease and some real encountering the challenge. The times in my practice that have been the difficult, most difficult, have been, of course, the most valuable for growing. The other thing I would say, just because I'm thinking about climate and here we are in Oregon going up into the mountains for a retreat, there is actually a sense of ethical conduct like we're going off the grid. These cabins don't have electricity. We don't have a car. We won't be driving. The food we're eating is very simple. You know, doesn't come in plastic. Most of it is coming right from the farm. So there is a sense of responsibility in terms of what I can do for this year in simple living, in not contributing to my carbon footprint. That also just feels good. It feels like this is a good time to be much simpler and to cut down on conveniences for the world, you know? That also feels like a good thing.
Yeah, I think that is so inspiring to listen to you. Also, when you think about, you know, how anxious we all are, how busy we all are, like, is this really how we want to live? But it's so difficult to take a different direction. It's extremely difficult to go off the grid and to decide I'm going to live a more simple life. I find it very challenging to take that kind of decision. I live in a solar paneled house, but that's almost more by chance than anything else. Yeah. And I think it's interesting to reflect upon what you said, that yes, it's difficult to be in retreat because you meet yourself all the time, because you're watching your mind all the time, your mind and your heart. But also that what you gain from it, that intimacy that you were talking about with the river, with the trees, with the lizards and the birds. I mean, and you were talking about meaning, like what does it mean to live a meaningful life? I mean, that to me sounds like to be really intimate with life in every shape and form, whether it's a river or a robin or a lizard, and your own heart and body and your partner and so on. That seems to me to get more and more intimate by going on retreats seems to me extremely meaningful. So what does it mean to you? What is a truly meaningful life to you, if you could put some words on that?
I think you said it beautifully. That's a lot of it. Growing the beautiful qualities of the heart, realizing this mind's potential. Also, waking up to the beautiful interdependence of it all. We're so intricately connected. I think there's so much in this world that we, especially modern culture, that bases value on money, on success, on busyness, on work, right? On the size of your house. Those are just values that we take for granted. That's how we live meaningfully. And yet the very basis of the Buddhist path is about renunciation. You know, how is it to really think about how do I simplify? And noticing when we lean into simplicity, we get happier often, you know, if we can let go of some of the extras. It's interesting, you know, this past 18 months has been incredibly difficult. So much illness and loss and sickness and death, of course. And so many people I talked to were really saying how beautiful it was to have a simpler life at home with their families, you know, not rushing all over the place or traveling so much. It's really, I think there's also a part of the human heart that wants the mystical, but also really can settle and rest when things are simpler. Yeah. And that's a discipline. But there's something to be said, I think, for looking at what is extra in my life and what really does hold meaning for me. I'm constantly struggling with that. I'm too busy, you know, I'm all engaged in all these things. And yet the value I have is really in like spaciousness, in free time, in using my time in ways that, yeah, isn't just assumed, like following the social mores of what a healthy lay life should look like, but like, who do I really want to be spending my time with? How do I want to be working? How much do I want to be working? And I know all these questions come from a lot of privilege that I have these, you know, the room to make these choices, but it also comes with sacrifices. You know, we are, both my partner and I are never going to be really wealthy because we're valuing other ways to work, simpler ways. And so I do think it feels good, especially in this time of excess, to be considering just the question you asked, you know, what are my values? What really is a meaningful life to me? And then it takes some discipline sometimes to follow those and time, you know, for conditions to fall into place.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, and it takes real decision. It takes real strength of heart and mind, actually, to take the decision to take a different path than the mainstream path. Yeah. I think that's very admirable, actually.
Yeah, people question it. You know, I sometimes question it just with your question around, like, shouldn't we stay engaged? We have a good life here. So yeah, it does take some fire. And that's when going back to read the Buddha's teachings is so helpful. Like, why are we really practicing? We're not practicing to have a better life here. You know, he was really like, this is how to get off the cycle, off the wheel. And so for me, every day, remembering that motivation is important too.
Yeah. That probably sounds strange to some people, like, you just want to check out of this world.
Right.
But yeah, I understand what you mean. I did want to touch upon one last thing, because you and your husband, Nico, you've written a beautiful book, and it's also as an audiobook. And I listened to the audiobook that you and him read. You read one chapter and he reads one chapter, and I cannot recommend it enough. It's on Audible. The book is called How Not to Be a Hot Mess, right? It's a while since I read it. So that book is, it's very much about ethics, you know, and we haven't spoken about ethics here. So why was that important for you guys to write? I mean, it doesn't sound like the most sexy subject in the world, like meditation teachers and young. I mean, you're both young, both you and Nico, writing about morals. So
absolutely.
I know you do it in such a gracious and very funny way. It's really engaging, the book, and it's also very good for young people. But why did you choose that theme to write about ethics and the importance of them?
Right. This comes from, it's more of a history. So we were both living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time. And here this comes full circle, because we were able to work with Richie Davidson eventually at his neuroscience lab. So in 2016, we were there. Nico was just finishing his PhD. And to be honest with you, the 2016 elections really shook us both in a big way. I think we saw, we're in this country and maybe in the world, we're in a crisis, in a moral crisis, right? We have an ethical crisis. Our leaders are lying. They're not valuing honesty. And in fact, these values of deceit, of power, of sort of always getting ahead, competition, the me first attitude is so, so like spread out, right? It's so predominant. And so we were also doing a lot of work around structural racism, oppression, and really seeing how the Buddhist precepts, this basic foundation in training, that's not like 10 commandments, but more like these are trainings that we can cultivate in our minds. They incline towards well-being. They bring happiness when we're living in a generous way, when we're honest with ourselves and others, we're careful with our sexual energies. Yeah. You know, we're not taking what isn't given. These are foundational precepts that would really, if a lot of people were living by them, much more happiness, but also we might not have such problems like we do now. Mm-hmm. And so from those conversations, he and I were saying, you know, so helpful, these precepts, and also very not sexy. Like, who wants to hear about these rules, you know, especially for young people? And so our aim in the book was really to make them fun. You know, this can actually be a really fun training meditation because it makes us happy. You know, it's a little bit like we've been talking about, what's worthwhile is sometimes hard. Like, sometimes we do have to have discipline and we have to look at what's better for the whole rather than for me right away, right? Look in the long term. That runs counter to some human instincts. I think we're so short term, like immediate gratification.
Yeah.
But what we try to do in the book, I think, is make them fun, and also the sort of the reasoning, like the logic behind, if you live in alignment with these values, you'll be happier, right? We're happy when we're generous and honest and all the rest.
Yeah, you're not going to be a hot mess if you are a little bit more careful with your conduct, right?
That's the whole idea. Yeah, we wrote it, we published it right before the pandemic hit. So we didn't really know, like, the world actually really feels like a hot mess now. I don't think we really knew the implications of the title and what we're dealing with now. But I think, yes, even more so at these times is to really sit down and look, have a very honest look at ourselves. How are we living? Where, how do we want to be? How do we want to speak? How do we want to be with other people? That relational aspect of practice feels more important now than ever.
I think it's so important because I think we live a little bit in a culture where everything's up for grabs. Like it's all about pleasure. It's very hedonic, like just grab. It's also what we're doing to the earth, no? It's like these resources are here for us to grab and use however we please, however it satisfies us immediately, you know? So I think it's very timely also on a more global and even environmental way that we look at those things, that the world's not just up for grabs like that. That there's
That's
some
right.
responsibility and some ethics that they need to come back into our lives.
And that we're all connected. We can't just act for our own benefit. That always comes back to us in the end. So growing that kind of wisdom view too, that what we do makes a difference. It matters. That cause and effect view, really important.
And it doesn't make us happy when we act unethically. It's not, I don't think that's
That's right. So on some level, we feel it. We feel that it's contributing to the sense of split, of separation, when the truth is really so much about belonging, that when we act for the good of ourselves and others, we like it. It benefits us.
And it's also difficult to have a peaceful mind if you've been out stealing or
That's
or
right.
acting inconsiderately with your sexuality or whatever. It's difficult then to sit down and meditate.
That's right. That makes it harder. Makes it harder.
Devin, thank you so much for this conversation. I've been looking so much forward to speaking with you because I knew I was going to be really relaxed with you because I know you, and I just love your vision and your, I just love how you transmit these teachings. So very honored to have you on the podcast.
Me too. So honored, Dorita. And can I say one more thing?
Yeah, please.
I have one more piece, just because I think where we got to that very end around escape from samsara is an interesting point to make. So, just because I have these two lineages, wanting to make that distinction around early Buddhist teachings, the Buddha was really clear that we're practicing to get out of the cycle. And when we're out, we're out, we're free. Then in later developments, Mahayana, Vajrayana, we get this bodhisattva vow, which is actually seeing our interdependence, seeing how much we belong. I'm actually going to practice for my own liberation, but really on behalf of everyone, so that I'm going to delay my full enlightenment in order for every other being to get free first, right? So that bodhisattva based in altruism and like practicing not for myself alone. And sometimes those are tensions between the two traditions. Like some folks are, I'm out right away, and others are, well, I'm practicing to get free so that I can help other beings. And that, for me, holding both sometimes is, it does feel like, oh, these are different motivations. And so maybe coming full back circle to this sense of intention, why do we practice? Not that one or the other is better, but I think that it is, again, sort of good to be clear that this practice does benefit both ourselves and other beings. And in some ways, maybe it matters less whether we're getting out first or we're staying around to help people, but that we're practicing for freedom, right? And that might mean freedom on a collective scale. And ourselves getting free is going to inevitably help people. But I just think that's an important thing to name, is that practice always helps ourselves and others. And there can be a very altruistic intention that isn't just about getting out, right? That's very much about service as well.
I'm really glad you clarified that because I must admit, I was really surprised when you said to hear you say like I want to get out of samsara. I want to get out of here. I want to get enlightened so that I can get out. I was like, oh. Where's the bodhisattva that I know?
I know. Well, and it's an interesting question around your escape. You know, we're going on retreat to escape, literally. Like, people just want to get free. And that is what the Buddha was encouraging. So I think it's a both and. My sense is that people who are free really can help other people get free.
Yeah.
So it's kind of both and definitely, I would just say my personal view is just going to stick around until for as long as it takes for everybody to get free before I'm out.
Yeah. Also, yeah. I think it's very interesting that word freedom, because I love what Janis Joplin says when she says that freedom, it's just another word for nothing else to lose. Like, it sounds a bit boring. It's a bit like paradise in the Christian right. world. Like, then you just go up there and hang out with the angels. How interesting is that? You know,
right.
Like, whereas being a bodhisattva, I think, like, becoming free, but still being here and using my energy to help the world or to transmit something of benefit. I think that's much more interesting than just being free.
Yes, me too. That would be my personal preference. But we need all kinds of people to get free before we can be. So I think we need both.
Yeah.
And I also love, like, this is a good note to end on, maybe, is this question of what does freedom or liberation really look like?
Yeah.
You know, and for each of us, that might be a different answer. Might look like getting off the wheel for some. For some, it might look like deep engagement.
Yeah.
But from this sense of real spaciousness and equanimity,
yes,
it can look all kinds of different ways. So that can also be a good contemplation to bring to our practice. You know, what does it really feel like to be happy, contented, well, you know, at peace? What does that feel like? What does it mean?
Yes, I love that, because that means we have to speak again in a year, Devon, when you come out, and then see what has changed in your perception of what freedom really means.
Yes, that sounds great, Dorita. I'm curious to know too.
because I love that last reflection, that it might look different for each and everyone, and it evolves as we evolve. Yes. You know, it doesn't just stay static of what we mean by that.
Right. Yeah, different phases for sure. Yeah.
Thank you, Devon.
See you
in a year.
That's right. We'll do this again next summer. Sounds good.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Devon Haase, who is starting her one-year retreat in a remote cabin on a hillside, well accompanied by chipmunks, birds, and lizards. If you want to know more about Devon's offerings or mentoring, you can go to her website, which is www.devonandnicohaase.com. The link will also be in the show notes. And their book, How Not to Be a Hot Mess, is available everywhere that books are sold. If you felt inspired or learned something in this conversation, then I greatly appreciate it if you review and rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts. This, and subscribing to the podcast and sharing it with your friends, is truly the best way to support this endeavor. And lastly, if you feel called to go on a personal growth journey with me, then you are welcome to visit my website, www.doritaholm.com, and schedule a free 25 minutes one-on-one to see if we are a good fit. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for next episode. Until then, be well.